You are listening to Vueltas y Revueltas, the cycling podcast at the Vuelta a España, powered by Super Sapiens, energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Stage 2. Today we are in Burgos.
So first I had to sprint back to the wheel of, I think it was Molano and Matthews, but I didn't see the images. And then I had to launch again for the final sprint, and yeah, Matthews had to pass, I think, Molano, so I had to go right, and there was just maybe a split second where I lose some speed. But yeah, like I said, Phillips on the left, he was fast, and yeah, I guess he's a well-deserved winner today. Like they say, pressure makes diamonds, and today it was barely or almost a diamond, so we're going to just try and keep going, and for sure there is a win somewhere in this Vuelta.
Well, Daniel, we opened there with Fabio Jakobsen. We heard from him in last night's episode, of course. Today, a bunch sprint,
pressure,
and he was up there.
Pressure makes diamonds. What a quote. Does it, though?
Pressure
does
and it? Heat. Pressure and heat. And today, there was pressure and there was
You've
heat.
You've become, in the last hour, it's worth being
an aficionado.
As well as being aficionado of haggis. Diamond. What's the name for a diamond specialist? It's a spec. I don't know. I will have looked that up by the Isle of Wikipedia by the end
I'm
of
not,
episode.
I'm not. Whatever the name is, I'm not quite there yet. But it was an eye-catching or an ear-catching quote, wasn't it, from Jakobsen? And I guess it was one of the stories of this Vuelta would be, can Jakobsen return to the top and win stages here? He's won stages at the Vuelta before. He is still recovering, of course, from his horrific crash at the Tour of Poland last year. And he went very close today, didn't he? It was, we were watching the finish with Dutch and Belgian colleagues, weren't we? And one was shouting, Jakobsen. The other one was shouting, Philipsen. And it was very close. They went either side of the UAE lead out. It was hard to tell as they crossed the line who had won.
Would have been a great story had Jakobsen won, of course. Is it about? It's slightly less than a year since his crash in Poland, isn't it?
Or
it's
just over a year.
Just over a year. Would have been a fantastic story, but it's a good story anyway because Jasper Philipsen came very close a couple of times in the Tour de France and today completed his team's clean sweep of the first bunch sprints in every Grand Tour this year.
And what a story that is. And we'll talk a bit about it later on because they're a team who at the start of the year people would have said was all about one rider, Mathieu van der Poel. But they have more than proven their worth and proven that they've deserved to be at the Giro and at the Vuelta as well. And, you know, people questioned that too, that they perhaps were taking the place of local teams, of teams belonging to those countries, but they've more than deserved it.
Further cause to celebrate for Philipsen today, because he's also acquired a nickname, El Jamón Volante, the Flying Ham. Of course, we've had El Sanguinaccio Volante, Simon Yates, in the Giro d'Italia a couple of years ago, the Flying Black Pudding. We're in Burgos, which is famous for its morcilla with the blood sausage, black pudding of this area, which we've talked about quite a lot over the last couple of days. And today, we were reminded that Philipsen is from a place in Belgium called Ham, H-A-M, Jamón in Spanish. And rather apt, because he does go very well in the Vuelta,
Adam Yates
year.
Has to be the flying morcilla, no?
He could be, but he wasn't flying today, was he?
La morcilla volante. Would that be correct?
It would.
Volante. But he wasn't flying today, no, and we'll talk about that a bit later on. We are going to cross over to Lionel Burney and not Watford in a moment to get the story of what happened in
not
today's
Watford
stage.
Not Watford and not Burgos as well.
Not Burgos. Lionel Burney and not Burgos. We've got lots of interviews coming up. Daniel had a policy day of only interviewing 21-year-olds, so we'll hear from them. I interviewed Michel Cornelis, the sports director at Alpecin Fenix. We're going to hear from Max Schachmann, who came off in that crash as well, which has become a kind of tradition of the flat opening stages of Grand Tours. A big crash, this one with about 4.5 kilometres to go, and it's cost some riders some time. But without further ado, should we cross over to Lionel Burney?
Is Lionel Burney our Duke of Wellington? The Duke of Wellington was sort of driven out of Burgos in 1812 by the French, I think. Over to Lionel.
That was stage two, which started south of the city of Burgos and looped 166.7 kilometres through the sun-baked countryside, finishing back in the city with the anticipated bunch sprint. Given the course profile, and particularly with an uphill finish tomorrow, perhaps it was not a surprise that it was a carefully controlled day, although it could have been very different if the wind had blown. As it was, conditions were fairly calm, and so we had a sort of paint-by-numbers early Grand Tour sprint stage. I must admit, I did have something of a late afternoon siesta. The events of about 100 kilometres to go to 75 kilometres to go are a bit of a mystery to me, but I gather not an awful lot happened. When I woke up, the same three riders were away. Three riders from Spanish wildcard teams who got away very early on. They were Diego Rubio, riding for very much the home team, Burgos BH, and two Vuelta debutants, Sergio Roman Martin of Caja Rural and Xavier Miquel Azparen of Euskaltel. And their lead got to almost 4 minutes very early on and then was gradually pulled back in and held at a minute and a half or 2 minutes. And then when I woke up from my siesta, it was down to about a minute. And at that point, the peloton actually eased up and allowed the gap to open up again because no one wanted to catch the break too soon. It stayed more or less like that until 31 and a half kilometres to go when Rubio pushed on without the other two. And then he was caught with 20 kilometres to go by the peloton, which at that point was being led by Astana. Now, they were trying to lead out Alex Aramburu for the intermediate sprint. Aramburu had had that fantastic time trial yesterday and was wearing the green jersey, on loan from Primoz Roglic, of course, and he wanted to take some points in the intermediate sprint to give himself a chance of wearing the jersey by rights tomorrow, and he did that, finishing second to Fabio Jakobsen. Then it was all down to the finish, and the inevitable crash, as so often happens. It was a strange one, this, with around 4.2 kilometres to go. It seemed to be on a fairly straightforward stretch of slightly uphill road, but there was a touch of wheels in the middle, quite near the front of the bunch. Quite a few riders went down. A couple of Bora Hansgrohe riders were on the floor for a while. German champion Max Schachmann was certainly held up. And crucially, it was outside the 3 kilometre to go mark, which meant that anyone who was delayed knew they would be losing time overall. At the finish, it looked like it was going to be a shootout between Michael Matthews and Juan Sebastian Milano. Milano won a couple of stages of the Vuelta a Burgos last week, remember? And the pair of them were going shoulder to shoulder. But it was as if they were sprinting to an imaginary finish line 50 metres short of the real one, because they'd simply gone too early. And as they faded, Jasper Philipsen and Fabio Jakobsen came to the fore. And it was the Belgian Philipsen, who won a stage of last year's Vuelta as well, who got across the line just ahead of Jakobsen. And that gives Alpecin Fenix the Grand Tour Grand Slam. They've won a stage in all of this year's Grand Tours. Tim Merlier at the Giro and Tour and Matthew van der Poel at the Tour, of course. For Jakobsen, he'll have to wait for another shot at a Vuelta stage. He did win his last bunch sprint at the Vuelta in Madrid a couple of years ago. And remember, it's only a year and 10 days since that terrible crash at the Tour of Poland. I know he's had a couple of wins since his comeback, but to be mixing it in the bunch sprints at the end of a nervy finish like that, kind of boggles the mind, really. So anyway, it was Philipsen, Jakobsen, Matthews, Milano and Aramburu, the top five over the line. Unfortunately for Aramburu, he didn't quite do enough to keep the green jersey on his shoulders. Philipsen, Jakobsen and Aramburu are all tied on 50 points, but Philipsen will wear it because he had the better stage placing today. Of those who lost time, Adam Yates conceded 31 seconds. There was a group that came in at 38 seconds containing Jack Haig, Hugh Carthy, Wout Poels and Mark Padun. Rafał Majka lost a minute and 11, Pavel Sivakov a minute and 15, Schachmann 2:35, and Tom Pidcock, who was up there in the intermediate sprint and then sat up on the run-in, is at 4:16 when they got to the finish line. Overall, only a small change. Roglic, of course, still in the red jersey, but Aramburu has trimmed his lead to 4 seconds, and Michael Matthews is up to third, just 10 seconds back. But it will be the climbers who come to the fore tomorrow with the summit finish at almost 1,500 metres. So back to you guys in Spain, and hopefully you have something nice lined up for dinner.
You are listening to Vueltas y Revueltas, the cycling podcast at the Vuelta a España, powered by Super Sapiens, energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Still guessing on fueling? Not sure what or when to eat and drink on rides that matter? Never again. Optimize your fueling strategy with real-time glucose data, actionable insights, and personalized analytics. We're here to help you achieve your performance goals. Go to supersapiens.com for more on how to track your energy levels and fuel for success.
I'm Nathan Smith, I'm 20 years old, I'm from the UK and I ride for Team Novo Nordisk Development Squad. Obviously last year the team couldn't put on a in-person talent ID camp as they normally would because of obvious reasons really. So they partnered up with the Sufferfest and they put on a virtual one using Zwift as well and Wahoo trainers and everything. So, and then we had group rides, we had races, we had Zoom calls as well with the staff with the presentations and everything. And then I just went along, joined along, did everything, and then got an email afterwards and asking me to join the development team for this year. So they generally take people from the talent ID. So I knew what I wanted to happen, and I was hopeful, but obviously you never know if it will happen or not.
Thank you very much indeed to our title sponsor, Super Sapiens. We heard a bit there from Nathan Smith, one of the riders on the Novo Nordisk development team. I met him at the Novo Nordisk Talent ID camp that I went to a few weeks ago now in Normandy. If you would like to enter our competition to win 3 months' worth of Super Sapiens devices, go to thecyclingpodcast.com and you'll find out there how to record your 60 seconds or less of audio telling us how and why you would use Super Sapiens. We'll be hearing some of your entries over the course of the Vuelta. Well, Daniel, a bunch sprint. I had a quick conversation with our old pal Mitch Docker just before we started recording, former lead-out man himself, and he watched today with great interest because there are a couple of really fast sprinters here. You know, there's not a lot of sprinters, but there are a couple of good ones. I was reminded as Matteo Trentin led it out how a few years ago he was so dominant in these bunch sprints in the Vuelta in a year when there were perhaps weren't too many of the very top sprinters. But there are two or three good sprinters here. He was lead out man today. Mitch said he got it wrong. He did a very strong lead out, but got it wrong by going down the middle and leaving Milano to be attacked on
someone
either side.
Someone else who did the same thing was Luka Mezgec, also a very good lead out for Matthews, went straight down the middle.
Yeah, and as Mitch said, seemed to have a chat with Matthews about 200 metres to go as well. Matthews put himself in a brilliant position to win today. He was in the perfect position to win, but he's not quite the kind of sprinter that a Jakobsen or a Philipsen is.
Do you know what Matthews' problem today was? He said after the stage that his heart rate never went above 100. And it was
even in the sprint.
That was what I took from that.
My heart rate was above 100.
Probably
watching
not enough
sprint
to win a bunch sprint in the Vuelta. One would be alarmed. It reminded me, actually, there's a famous interview with Alan Piper when Alan Piper was a rider. And I think this was either in 1990 or 1991 Tour de France. And he was asked after a few stages, who's going to win the Tour? And he said, Claudio Chiappucci, mate. And he told a story of how he'd been riding alongside Claudio Chiappucci in the peloton. And Chiappucci, Alan had inquired how well was Chiappucci going. And Chiappucci just pointed to his heart rate monitor. And his heart rate monitor was under 100. And I think Alan's was getting close to 150.
Funny, in those days it was all about heart rate monitors. That was the cutting edge of technology. Now it would be all about power meters, wouldn't it? It's funny how things have changed. Let's move on from Claudio Chiappucci and his heart rate.
Low though, isn't it? 100. That's not even. Low. Is that even? No, it's not even zone two for.
No, very,
those
very
of
much
you
in
who
zone,
are au fait with these
zone
things.
Zero.
And it was. It's extremely hot. We're always told that heart rate, well, I've seen this myself, heart rate goes up by around, you know, often 10 beats in sort of 30 degree heat as against sort of 15 degree heat or 10 degree heat. So 100 or below 100 is very low.
Pretty low. One thing we observed today was when we woke up, it was A, quite cold, and B, the wind was very blowy and strong. And we did fancy crosswinds today. The wind seemed to blow quite hard before the start and then immediately after the finish, but during the stage itself, it didn't really deliver. So we didn't have the crosswinds, we didn't have the echelons, and we had a fairly conventional kind of flat stage with a breakaway from the Spanish teams were represented there, and then a big bunch sprint with a crash with 4.5 kilometres to go. We'll get onto that a bit later on. But the sprint itself, I mean, Jasper Philipsen, you know, they tried to give him a really good chance at the Tour de France, and he couldn't quite get a stage win there. And he's a rider who, when he emerged 2 or 3 years ago, was great things were expected of him. I think there was a lot of surprise when he stepped back from the World Tour the end of last year, joining Alpecin Fenix. But as I said in the first part, that's a team that has punched well above its weight this year and has certainly proven that it's far more than a Mathieu van der Poel vehicle.
Yeah, and they remind me of the Sunweb of a few years ago in the sense that they've created not only one team, not only a plan A of very fast riders and a great lead-out train around Merlier or even van der Poel or Philipsen. They've got maybe 10 or 12 riders who can be slotted in and out of lead-out trains, you know, with the likes of Krieger was there today. We're going to even hear from a Vuelta debutant, a 21-year-old.
Well, of course.
Of course, later in the podcast, who slotted in Tobias Beyer. But they've got a lot of riders of that nature. They know what they are, what they're not. They're well aware of the fact that come the second and third week of Grand Tours, they're going to be a lot less prominent than in the first week. But it's certainly worked for them so far.
They've got Sasha Modolo, who is formerly a top sprinter himself. They've recruited very cleverly, you know, it appears. And well, let's hear from the sports director. I went up to their bus at the finish. They were cock-a-hoop there. Michel Cornelis is a sort of veteran Dutch sports director. He's been around a few teams. I spent a day in a team car with him at the Tour of Britain a few years ago. And he talked a little bit about Philipsen's win and how important it was for him, and about how the Rudhoff brothers, who are Mathieu van der Poel's longtime managers, they've looked after him from a young age, and they now run the team together, Philip and Christoph, how clever they've been in putting this team together.
I mean, an incredible achievement. You won stages in all three Grand Tours. I guess that was the goal coming into the Vuelta.
Yeah. Of course, it was a goal, but it's not so easy to do. But we were have a good morale this morning because we say, yeah, we win the second stage in the Giro, the second in the Tour. So why not the second in the Vuelta? And everybody believes in it. And I think we saw a very strong team the last 5Ks. It was the plan, and we say we do our own sprint here, and we don't watch the other teams, and it worked out fantastic. It's fantastic if you win, of course, but you make a plan, it's not always working, but today the plan was completely working.
Jasper has gone close, hasn't he? And he's been in a supporting role as well. We saw him in the supporting role at the Tour, so he's been knocking at the door. This is well deserved for him.
Yeah, it's also very, very mental important for him that he wins now, because he was so close every time in the Tour de France, and in the last day on the Champs-Élysées, then he was beaten by Wout van Aert. So now it's very important also for his mind that he's winning here against Jacobs, who was also on a high level again. So yeah, I think he's very happy with it, and it's very important for him for the next coming days.
I mean, at the start of the season, a lot of people would have said this team was all about Mathieu van der Poel. It must be very satisfying to have proven, you know, and a lot of people would have questioned even your right to be in these Grand Tours. Yeah. It must feel good to have answered some of those questions.
And then I must give a big compliment to the Boat Brothers Roodhoofd. They always say we want the team. Mathieu is very important for the team. But thanks to Mathieu, also the other riders believe more in themselves, and everybody comes on a higher level. And I think also Mathieu is happy that the team is more than only Mathieu van der Poel, because it puts all the pressure on him, and we show that we have more good riders than Mathieu.
You've been involved in other teams. I think I spent a day with you at the Tour of Britain in the team, the Garmin team car, many years ago. Is there something about this team, though? Is it the fact that van der Poel's in the team? Does that sort of take some of the pressure off some of the riders? Is there... You mentioned the brothers there, very, very important to the running of the team, but what is there some magic in the team?
I think thanks to Mathieu van der Poel, everybody works so hard for him, and then they see that themselves are also better riders when they ride in the front and they work for somebody else, and it brings them also to a higher level. That's thanks to Mathieu, because otherwise when they're riding for themselves, they're more careful and they're more in the back, and now they work hard and they see it bring results in the front. And that's important for the guys, and it opened their eyes that they can also win themselves.
And what else can we expect from the team in this Vuelta?
Yeah, if you have one, it always stays for more. Eh? But we're already happy that we have one, and now we can. We have also more better, also other riders. Eh? Jay Fine is very good. Thomas Bayer was very good in Burgos. Blancard was very good. It brings. It's always good for the morale if you win quickly a stage, and hope that we can win more. in this Vuelta.
Did Jay have a little crash today?
Yeah, his hand is very bad, but we the doctor is here. Maybe he looked to it and cleaned it up. And the morale is good, and that's also important.
That was Michel Cornelis, a very happy Michel Cornelis at the finish, celebrating Jasper Philipsen's win. And as I said earlier, he was also giving credit to the Rudhoff brothers, Philip and Christoph. If you want to know a bit more about that setup, have a listen to our special that we released last year. It's just called Van Der Poel. It's mainly an interview with Mathieu van der Poel's father, André van der Poel, but there's also Christoph Rudhoff in there, who talks a bit about managing Van der Poel and about putting this team together that is now Alpecin Fenix, and what they've been trying to do.
It's going to be interesting to see how Philipsen and Merlier reconcile roles or cohabit in the future, isn't it? Because, we were with a Belgian colleague earlier today, Guy van Landenberg, and he was talking to us about how Philipsen was a little bit put out when Merlier was inserted into the Tour de France team. That wasn't originally the plan. He was going to do the Giro, but he's really climbed the ladder of world sprinting this year, hasn't he, Merlier? And he's pretty much top tier. He's among the five or six guys who I think everyone considers the fastest in the world. So going forward, they're going to have some tough decisions to make. And, you know, at the Tour, it was some days for Merlier, some days for Philipsen, a little bit like Trek have tried to do in the past with Max Pedersen and Jasper Stuyven and others. But yeah, there will be some tough calls probably to make in the coming months and years.
Did I mention that Van Der Poel special is for friends of the podcast? And if you want to sign up as a friend of the podcast, go to thecyclingpodcast.com and you'll find that among lots of other episodes there. It's a great story. And the other story was Jakobsen. I mean, that too, as he told us last night, would have been a fairy tale had he won. He's still got lots more chances in this Vuelta. And it is great to see him certainly sprinting at a very high level again. He said last night he's not scared of these bunch sprints. He's overcome any fear he might have had. He doesn't want to crash, clearly, but it's quite a feat also, not just to get back to his old level physically, but to be able to contest these bunches, because we have seen in the past, you know, bunch sprinters are, you know, they're doing what they do depends so much on bravery, courage, on almost blocking out the fear that must be there. And he's done incredibly well within a year to come back and just be able to contest these finishes again.
And I would suggest as well, the Vuelta is the best of the Grand Tours, the best place to do it, to reacquaint himself with that feeling, because usually the roads into the towns, even a straighter, bit less road furniture than we see at the Tour de France. And at the Giro, the weather tends to be more consistent and there aren't as many big sprint trains. So it's usually, today's crash notwithstanding, a bit of a cleaner run in.
And he has the speed. I mean, today, as we heard in his interview, he had the slightly longer line to the finish, having to go around Matthews, and Philipsen had the slightly shorter line up the inside after the perfect lead out by Matteo Trentin for both of them. So, you know, the speed is there, and he was coming pretty fast at the end. So I'm sure he's got what it takes to win a stage here.
Still couldn't get the better of El Jamón Volante, the flying ham. Do you think he's going to stick?
No.
Talking of Jamón, Richard, last night we gave this a big build-up, didn't we? We went to a restaurant called La Jamada, not El Jamón, La Jamada, which, as we talked about probably ad nauseam yesterday, was run, set up by a gentleman who finished second or third, we weren't quite sure, in Spanish.
I'm not sure
top
even
chef,
call him a gentleman,
cocinero, and you were not impressed.
A crook. I mean, it was, Charlotte. I have to say, I have to call it out for what it is. I read a fantastic review from The Observer today by Jay Rayner of a fancy new place in London. I recommend anybody to go and read this. I think it's at the Dorchester Hotel. He absolutely slams this place. I'm not going to do quite the same, but it was a huge disappointment, I would say, because we were there at lunchtime. There were lots of staff, all uniform, all well-presented, uniformed, lots of staff buzzing around. The food coming out of the kitchen looked good. I had high hopes for last night. And what I was served, Daniel, was a bit of fatty steak in a roll and a very few chips.
I should caveat this by telling the listeners that your reviewer tonight is a gentleman who, when he first tasted gazpacho, many years ago in, I don't know, Kirkcaldy or wherever it is he's from.
He sent it back to the kitchen. No offense to anyone in Kirkcaldy.
He complained that it was cold and sent it back to the kitchen.
That's true. That was in 2008 and it was in a cafe on the King's Road in London and it was a buffet and I served myself some soup from the buffet, went to my table and it went back and complained that
not
it was
sure
cold.
A man of that gastronomic really sophistication should be doing.
But you're detracting here, Daniel. This place last night was on your recommendation. It's your responsibility. I trust your judgment on these things, and your judgment let us down last night.
Well, Richard, possibly the final bit of Epicurean content this evening. I promised this feature in the Vuelta Pinchos y Pinchazos. Pinchos being this kind of tapas that they have in north of Spain on cocktail sticks. Pinchazos being punctures or also injections, alarmingly. But it can also be a COVID jab. So there's going to be some kind of mention of something vaguely related to one of those themes every day. Today it was going to be pinchos because I read about these pinchos that Burgos is semi-famous for. And where we were this afternoon, the suburb of Gamonal has got a lot of bars that serve these vinagrillos. And these sort of pinchos that are, well, they're pickles, really. Razor clams, what else is the anchovies, olives, with a cocktail stick stuck through them and all sort of marinated in a kind of vinegar dressing. And we were very close to some famous places to get these vinagrillos at the finish, but it's Sunday and everywhere
Daniel,
was closed.
Daniel, someone's taking our photograph. What's going on?
And it was the place that I'd earmarked was closed, which was very disappointing. One reason I was very keen to go to this place this evening, Richard, is because present company taken into consideration, I'm traveling with a Scotsman, and I read a review of this bar which raved about how cheap it was. You could get two glasses of white wine and some of these vinagrillos for €1.20.
Stop stereotyping. Well, I hope you can deliver us somewhere a bit better tonight, Daniel.
Science in Sport is supporting the cycling podcast at the Vuelta a España. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to our long-time sponsor, Science in Sport. If you would like 25% off all your Science in Sport products, go to scienceandsport.com and at the checkout, enter the discount code SISCP25. SISCP25, and thanks once again to Science and Sport for their support of the cycling podcast. We are very grateful.
Yeah, that was a bad moment for us today. Jordi's sprinter crashed. I also couldn't stop anymore because I just came with more speed from the back to bring him up to the front and that little kicker. But yeah, unfortunately, that was the moment they crashed in front of us. It was quite. Yeah, quite hectic in the bunch, but still quite okay. Despite the crash, it was quite okay, yeah.
And, well, you've got some problems with the injuries of your teammates today, but did you already think that tomorrow's stage to Picon Blanco might be an opportunity for you?
No, I don't think so. I don't think it's an opportunity for me. I'm there to help Felix for the GC, and yeah, that's my goal, my task for tomorrow.
You're looking more at the small climbs at the end of stages, the 2 and 3 kilometer climbs at the end of stages. Is that the case?
Yeah, I will see. Maybe, probably, or one of the days in the breakaway. I will just get into the race and make a plan later.
Well, that was Max Schachmann, who came off pretty badly in the crash. And he was sort of the biggest name, actually, who actually fell, I think. But others lost time as a result of it. You've been studying the footage, haven't you?
His team came off very badly, Richard.
Team did, yeah.
Shaq himself, Shaq attack, he came down, had a little bit of a grazed knee. He was bleeding at the finish, but was pretty unfazed, certainly as far as his own injuries were concerned. But the same could not be said of Patrick Gamper, his Austrian teammate. And Jordi Meus as well, the Belgian sprinter, who I think was supposed to sprint for Bora today, but he also came down, and they both finished, those guys, but didn't look particularly happy when they did or in a particularly good way. Will we keep our fingers crossed that they're able to start tomorrow?
Gamper looked at one point, he was sort of holding his shoulder and you feared the old broken collarbone, didn't you? But there were other riders caught up in the crash. You've been studying the footage. Adam Yates was just behind the crash when it happened. He didn't actually go down, but he did sort of have to pick his way through it. Hugh Carthy was even further back, and that was just inattention, wasn't it? 4.5 kilometres to go, if you're here to try and finish on the podium, you really have to be further up the bunch.
Well, particularly, you know, we talked yesterday about Hugh Carthy having lost time, quite significant time yesterday in the first stage. Yates, this has been an issue that he's had. I don't think he sees it as a problem, but certain directors sportifs he's had would have liked him to ride a bit close to the front of the peloton in the past. He's become kind of notorious, and there are a handful of riders, or even GC riders, who have this style of moving around the peloton or not moving around the peloton, staying at the back most of the time. And Yates, I mean, he was sort of middle to back of the peloton. He didn't have a teammate right next to him, right in front of him. As I say, some guys prefer that way of riding rather than fighting for positions as they go into the final 3 kilometres. And Carapaz and Bernal were certainly closer to the front. There's a lot of luck involved. Roglic narrowly missed the crash as well. He was a fair way back. But, you know, it just reminded me of what Theo Gegenhardt said a week or so into the Tour de France about Ineos's three-leader strategy at the Tour de France. It's impossible to protect three guys. And Yates came into this Vuelta as one of Ineos's notional leaders, and he's already lost. How many seconds did he lose today, Rich? 28 seconds?
31 seconds.
I mean, so that, it's obviously bad news for that and the strategy.
And the strategy, but all the gains yesterday as well. He rode so well yesterday relative to a lot of the other GC riders, and all those gains kind of wiped out today. I mean, was it a surprise that he was on his own when the crash happened, and also afterwards? I mean, you know, there wasn't. You know, had it been Bernal, say, would Puccio or even a Sivakov or somebody have gone back, or Narvaez or somebody to wait for him, or to try and help him a bit, because he seemed to be on his own afterwards. There wasn't a lot of time, and it's pretty frantic at that moment in the race.
Yeah, and it's difficult to judge, having not seen him throughout those last 4 kilometres, to see whether there was indeed a teammate helping him.
And there's not a lot they can actually do at that point either.
It doesn't look like it from the results. It doesn't. There are no teammates around him in the results. So I think he simply rode those last 4.2 kilometres on his own, tried to limit losses as best as he could. But Carthy and Yates weren't the only big hitters to lose time. Yesterday, well, we talked about the Bahrain victorious leadership hierarchy, didn't we? And we, having spoken to Jack Haig, it seemed pretty clear to us that Lander is their sole leader, at least at the moment. Haig himself lost a bit of time. He got caught behind the crash as well, almost 40 seconds. And Mark Padun, who a lot of people thought was going to be the, well, breakout star or the giant killer of this Vuelta a España, he underperformed, I would say, yesterday in the time trial, and he also lost a fair bit of time today again, 38 seconds.
Well, Daniel, there is a slightly more relaxed feel to the Vuelta. The late starts, the sunshine, the heat induces a sort of languid kind of atmosphere.
Sub-100 heart rates.
On the place, sub-100 heart rates. Yeah, we're all very relaxed here. And the bunch sprints perhaps aren't as chaotic and frantic and crash-riddled as they are at the Giro and the Tour. I don't know, it just doesn't feel like there's as much at stake. You know, at the Tour, the intensity is part of the reason for the crashes, the sort of fear that the riders are riding under. Here, there's just a different atmosphere.
We tend to see it as a less daunting prospect, certainly for inexperienced riders, neo-pros. We tend to see neo-pros at the Vuelta, which isn't necessarily the case at the Giro, certainly not the case at the Tour de France very often. And there were a lot, you pointed out, didn't you, yesterday, Rich, the number of sub or under 22-year-olds that are here at the Vuelta. I think it was 7 or 8.
I think there's 7 21-year-olds and 2 20-year-olds, which is extraordinary, really.
And taking my lead from that, Richard, I announced at the start this morning that I put out a press release to you in the car that I was only going to interview 21-year-olds at the start, and I picked out 2 who have caught my eye. I'm interested to follow their fortunes over the next 3 weeks. Tobias Bayer, the Austrian rider for Alpecin Phoenix, who surprised everyone, I think, a couple of weeks ago at the Vuelta a Burgos on the stage, Rich, over Picon Blanco, where we're going tomorrow, the first mountain stage of this Vuelta a Burgos. And the other one was an Australian, a Queenslander, mate, called Sebastian Berrick,
who is sorry, Australians who are listening.
Who has had a slightly unconventional route into the World Tour. He was with the AG2R under-23 team and also a team back home in Australia. And has been given a three-year contract by Israel Startup Nation, which indicates that they have a lot of faith in him. And he's a GC rider. But we're going to hear now from both of those, Bayer first and Berrick second.
Yeah, my family came here to surprise me for my first Grand Tour. They're also here at the start now and will be at the finish today as well.
And tomorrow we go to Picon Blanco, which in the Vuelta a Burgos, I think was a bit of a surprise for you, wasn't it? Because you were climbing with the best riders and you don't consider yourself a climber, do you?
No, actually not really. I would say like more all-rounder classics type, but I was surprised by myself and for sure I have good memories on Picon Blanco. I know I can climb well, and the team asked me to give it a try, and so I just tried and tried to hang on for as long as I can, but for sure I didn't expect to ride over the top with the best riders there, but I had to go really, really deep to hang on, and then I knew if I arrive with the climbers, I'm the fastest in the sprint of the group.
So I read an interview in which you said, as a 15-year-old, you did a 560-kilometer race at Oberösterreich-Rundfahrt, no?
Yeah, that's basically like where it started. We did it in a two-man team. It was just like just for fun, and afterwards I got like more serious and I wanted to try like some real races. But for sure it's a completely new experience. I'm curious what to expect in the second or third week, because till now my longest race was 10 days, which was also like long, but now it's double the days.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited about the whole situation I'm in right now. I'm just looking forward to the next 21 days here and hopefully I can show myself in some good stages. Came through maybe a little bit of an unorthodox method for Australians, I guess, for the current times. Came through the AG2R development team, then I went to St. George, which was real a big stepping stone for me, and I thought it was probably the best thing for my development, and it was in the end. Ended up doing some good results in Australia with that Sun Tour Australian Championships, and was cut short last year due to COVID, which was going to be a very good year for me. But yeah, I'm here now, so I can't complain. It's banking and get pretty windy, and like today's like today and tomorrow and whatnot, just the wind picks up and it's a bit very stressful in the bunch, but everything else I think I'm pretty covered on, especially at the Vuelta. The weather, like cold conditions, aren't too much of a worry, just the wind mainly. Probably next year I'll have a bit more open of a role at this Vuelta, probably more stages and just trying to develop more and get the legs used to three-week racing. So yeah, we'll see how it goes after these next 3 weeks, and next year will be a big year, I think.
And just finally, something you're looking forward to, kind of maybe away from the race, about the Vuelta?
The end of the last stage, I guess. That'd be good to see, and have a good night there.
Corrections corner, Daniel, there are six 21-year-olds and two 20-year-olds. Tom Pidcock is 22 years and 15 days, or 16 days now, actually. There's a lot of young riders in the race, and the riders are getting younger and younger all the time, or perhaps we're just getting older and older.
Well, we do get older, Rich. We change countries. You've changed country. You're on your way to becoming a Frenchman. I left
the French have got quite strict rules about that. I've got a way to go before I could become a Frenchman, I think.
We've left Kirkcaldy, you now live in France. And
what have you got against Kirkcaldy?
nothing. I like Kirkcaldy. There's some good golf courses near Kirkcaldy. But yes, Richard, big life changes. There are people at the Vuelta who are experiencing similar life changes at the moment. I've noticed one in the last fortnight. There's a rider in this Vuelta a España who was Italian 2 weeks ago and is now Polish. Who is it?
He's a former diarist for us. He kept an audio diary for us at the Giro d'Italia last year.
Cesare Benedetti, who he feels like his name needs to be Polishicized somehow.
We've got El Cid, we've got Caesar, we've got, you know, it's a El Civ, sorry.
Anyway, let's hear how this came about. Why is Cesare Benedetti riding at the Vuelta with a Polish flag next to his name?
Well, Cesare, a few weeks ago, I noticed that you have officially become Polish. Is that right? And can you tell me what the process was?
Actually, it was 10 days ago. I got a notification from the UCI. I made my request in July. Actually, I thought it would start from January, with the new season, 2022. But it seemed that things went quicker than I thought. And I'm now racing under the Polish flag.
And we know, is she your partner or your wife is Polish? You've been living there for a while, you speak Polish. But nonetheless, was it a bit of a strange feeling to become a different, you know, to have a different flag by your name?
I've got double passport now. And let's say with the support of Polish fans, of all the Polish people involved in cycling, I decided to make this step. And it's also it's very motivating, and it's I don't have the word for my family, you know. It's a kind of
It makes me proud.
Yes, Duma. My family is proud, and that makes me proud as well.
How are you?
It's a new kind of new beginning, you know.
A bit too late for the Olympics, but were you also thinking about maybe World Championships in the future and that possibility?
Anyway, you know, for the Olympics, you need to wait, I think, 3 years from the moment you've changed. But no, I wasn't really thinking about major races. I just want to represent the country as well as possible in the race and out from the race. And I will just race as always, and we will see what's coming. But if they will want me, then with pleasure. Yeah.
And just lastly, you've still got your Italian passport and your dual citizen. But what did your Italian friends and family say? What do they think about it?
My family is okay. They know I'm proud of my Polish Polish life. And I don't know about friends. Close friends, they know me, so it's no problem. And it's still a recent new. I haven't got any feedback yet. And now I'm concentrated on the race, and then we will see.
Cesare Benedetti, who fortunately for Bora, he was one of the Bora riders who came through unscathed today, wasn't he?
Yes, he did, Daniel. A rider who a few years ago now kept an audio diary for us and then 2 days later won a stage of the Giro.
Could it be tomorrow? Unlikely to be tomorrow. I also asked his teammate Max Schachmann whether he might target tomorrow's stage, and he thinks that it's too hard for him to climb to Picon Blanco.
I mean, what are we expecting? We start tomorrow, and I'm sure we'll talk about this more in tomorrow night's episode. We were reminded of this by our colleague Pete Cousins, who we had dinner with last night, that very disappointing dinner. Pete suffered through it as well, but he reminded us that tomorrow's stage starts by Sad Hill Cemetery, which features in The Good, the Bad and the Ugly. It was built for that film.
Sounds like an advert for our podcast.
Yeah, Sad Hill Cemetery. So we'll check that out tomorrow. And it's a real kind of a tourist attraction these days, I believe. Don't know much more about it, but we'll visit there tomorrow. As for the climb,
Rich, the Picon Blanco it's become a bit of a favourite of the Vuelta a Burgos in the last few years. There was a stage that, as I say, went over the Picon Blanco and finished back on the plain just over a week ago, won by Romain Bardet, who is here as well. So he will be looking forward to tomorrow. First using the Vuelta a Burgos in 2017, winners there, Ivan Sosa, Superman, Mikel Landa and Remco Evenepoel in the 2021 edition. 2020 edition was sort of discovered by, I mentioned Iñigo Cuesta last night, and I think there might be a bit of a corrections corner here. I think I said he holds the record for the most Vueltas. I think it's the most consecutive Vueltas. I don't know if that changes things, but 17 consecutive Vueltas, and he is from a little village near Burgos. He encouraged the organizers of the Vuelta a Burgos to include this very steep, very spectacular climb, which will host the finish tomorrow. And Rog says, Primoz Roglic, the race leader, says he doesn't know the climb at all.
Some breaking news, Daniel. We've just had a latest diary entry from Pavel Sivakov. Let's have a quick listen to that, because there might be some information in that pertaining to the crash today that saw Adam Yates lose some time.
Hey guys, yeah, first road stage of the Vuelta done and dusted, finished safe and sound. Was supposed to be a bit of a crazy day today. Honestly, I think everyone was really nervous about that day today. Super hot day, super hot stage. We started, I could feel a bit of tension, you know, on the start line. Everyone was expecting a lot of wind. Obviously, the Burgos area is really open, and I've done Burgos last week, Tour of Burgos, and realized that, yeah, I was expecting a bit of a crazy day, and at the end it went, it was a bit more calm than expected. Obviously a bit of stress in a bunch, as always, on those opening days of a Grand Tour.
What was El Civ, Pavel Sivakov, with a little bit of his diary. We'll hear more of that and his previous entries of diary. Also James Knox and Joan Bau, who rides for Euskaltel Euskadi. Those three riders keeping all the diaries for us at this Vuelta. And that will be the first episode of Kilometre Zero tomorrow.
El Civ, continuing this torturous narrative about El Civ. Rich, have you ever seen El Cid, the film?
With the very famous
Charlton Heston film in 1961?
I haven't. I've been reading about it, though.
Yeah, did you read? There's a story that caught my eye that Sophia Loren was the sort of love interest in El Cid, and she sued the production company because on the enormous billboard that was displayed in Times Square after the film was released, her name appeared underneath Charlton Heston's, and this led to a very high-profile lawsuit, apparently.
Did not know that. Nothing whatsoever to do with the Vuelta.
But Pavel
it's
Sivakov.
A film that I clearly need to watch. It's called El Cid, isn't it?
And it's rated as one of the great epics
of the
20th century.
And I've never watched it. Have you ever watched The Good, the Bad and the Ugly?
Yes.
Many, many years ago.
Yes.
But maybe remind myself of that tonight. With a few YouTube clips from
Sad Hill
Cemetery.
Very famous, Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, Enrico Morricone.
Yeah, maybe we'll play a bit of that tomorrow night if we can get away with it. But as I said, episode one of Com Zero will come out tomorrow, and that will feature the audio diaries James Knox, De Koenig, Quickstep, Pavel Sivakov, and Joan Bau.
Well, Rich, not too much wine chat tonight, but this is the first stop on our Viticulture of Vuelta a España in conjunction with Divine Cellars. The Vuelta a España selection is still available from Divine Cellars. All the details at www.divinecellars.com. It's a Ribera del Duero. At the start today, we were heading down towards Aranda del Duero, and we headed through the vineyards, didn't we, of the Ribera del Duero region. The first wine in the selection is the 2019 Flores de Callejo. We've not had any. I think the Duke of Wellington in not Watford might have had a case delivered.
He's imbibing,
but no Andy Hood tonight. No, our colleague from Velo News is not here to
argue
to
with
upbraid
you.
Me for choosing Ribera del Duero instead of Rioja on this lovely, warm, late summer's night.
Daniel, last night I premiered my incredible Vlasov joke, 3-2-1 Vlasov, And a few people on social media have told me Carlton Kirby made exactly the same joke. Carlton Kirby made exactly the same joke. Extraordinary. Great minds think alike is all I can say. Are we going to finish for tonight then? Where are we eating tonight?
We are eating at somewhere where they will no doubt serve morcilla, because I've looked in vain for other local specialities. There don't seem to be too many. I haven't found any queso de Burgos yet, which I was told to look out for. A lovely sort of feta type cheese. But we will report back, Richard, on what specialities we find tomorrow.
Who's going to win tomorrow? Daniel.
Rog.
Okay, there we go. That's all then for tonight. Thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you, Richard.